What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Bo Bergdahl prisoner swap, GM says incompetence, no cover-up, the president in Europe for D-Day remembrance, and more. The whole world has seen the Taliban video of Bo Bergdahl's release. The president said again yesterday, no apologies.
I make absolutely no apologies for making sure that we get back a young man to his parents and that the American people understand that this is somebody's child.
GM's CEO speaks to a long-delayed recall. Mary Barra blamed incompetence and neglect.
Repeatedly, individuals failed to disclose critical pieces of information that could have fundamentally changed the lives of those impacted by the faulty ignition switch.
And old soldiers gather for 70th anniversary observances for D-Day at the U.S. Military Cemetery overlooking Omaha Beach. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Margaret Brennan of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you read the Bergdahl swap, the Europeans on Russia, Mississippi's Republican primary, and the Tea Party? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Washington, Molly Ball, senior staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. She's been in Mississippi for the Republican primary this week. Molly Ball, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
Also with us from Washington, Margaret Brennan, foreign policy reporter for CBS News, watching Europe and more this week. Margaret Brennan, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Jack.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Molly, and Margaret.
Let's go right to that beach in Normandy where so many have gathered today, including those now many 90-plus year-old veterans of the D-Day storming of the beach there. President Obama spoke this morning, 70th anniversary, of course, paying tribute to all the allies and U.S. servicemen who, he said, waged war so that we might know peace.
And more than 150,000 souls set off toward this tiny sliver of sand upon which hung more than the fate of a war, but rather the course of human history.
Jack Beatty, there is so much context to this gathering on this beach this year at just this time. But before we get to all of that, the geopolitics of Vladimir Putin and who's having dinner with whom and all the rest, just this moment, 70 years on, Jack, and as many have said, this, for many, will be the last salute, the last hurrah for these veterans on this beach.
And you could see that in the ceremony today. The president turned after making his speech and went and shook hands with the veterans, and some of them tried to get up, and he said, no, don't rise. And you could see how fragile they were, and yet also how proud. You know, 70 years ago today, they were German machine guns were firing with a sound that one GI called like a Venetian blind being lifted up rapidly, perforating the beach, killing the wounded, and as someone said, re-killing the dead. And they faced that. You know, as I look at this, I'm just struck as the president was talking about that generation that it was in many respects a different country. For one thing, it was a fairer country. It was a country of shared sacrifice and shared prosperity. You know, you go to Harvard, you go to Yale, you look at the honor roll of men killed in the war. The elite fought right with the ordinary soldiers.
Rank on rank on those walls there, as well as very humble origins.
Absolutely. And the president, President Roosevelt, in his State of the Union speech in January 1944, outlined what he called an economic bill of rights for the post-war era. At the center of it, the GI Bill. But not just that, a promise that the American economy would always aim above all, for full employment, that we would not go back to the chronic unemployment of the 30s. And it was a time, of course, for great prosperity for African Americans who came up from the South, worked in the defense industries, women were working, unemployment was practically down to nothing, and there was a sense that people were fighting for a better world, but they were all fighting together, shared sacrifice and shared prosperity.
A different country, perhaps, Margaret Brennan, a different alliance as well. Many attestations to how important, how key it was all those years ago, the Allies. Now we have Germany sitting at the table for decades now, a part of the Western European alliance, and a new challenge this time coming out of Russia, who also shares in the ceremony, of course, because Russians fought bitterly on the Eastern Front against the same Nazi threat, Margaret.
Absolutely, Tom. And it's really interesting because, as you say, I mean, Germany has now become the economic engine for Europe and really the glue that's helping to keep that EU alliance together right now, that same European Union alliance that's sort of been facing off in many ways with Russia over how the fate of Ukraine is going to be determined, whether they economically and politically become more aligned with a Europe that says it's free and fair and democratic, or go more towards Russia that plays more towards the post-Soviet alliance here that feeds on some more nationalistic tendencies. It's a really interesting moment to see, as we saw today, a very brief conversation, probably a tense one, with President Obama and Russian President Putin on the sidelines there. As we celebrate an alliance, it's not clear that there is that same sense of shared values at the moment.
The president in Europe much of the week, first in Eastern Europe, where he sought to reassure those Poland and more right on the edge of the Russian sphere that they would have tough protection from NATO and beyond. Then back in the heart of Western Europe, where at a joint press conference here with the UK's Prime Minister, David Cameron, this was in Brussels, President Obama said he was hopeful that the U.S. and Europe would stand together to act forcefully against Russian aggression in Ukraine. But you can hear him urging on Europeans who have big economic stakes in this.
I think Europeans understand that the reason we've seen such extraordinary growth and peace on this continent has to do with certain values and certain principles that have to be upheld. And when they are so blatantly disregarded, the choice is clear. Europeans have to stand up for those ideals and principles, even if it creates some economic inconvenience.
But the choice was perhaps not so clear at every moment. This week, France confirming it will sell $1 billion-plus warship to the Soviet Union, will train 400, Russia, will train 400 Russian soldiers in France. These are armaments, a ship that could be used for going ashore in lots of other countries that are worried about all this. And Vladimir Putin, in the middle of all the back and forth this week, though not at the G7, he was cut out of that, but here, sort of right in the face of the United States, talking with France's Radio Europe 1 and TV TF1 in Sochi, this was on Tuesday before he came, said that, this is Vladimir Putin saying, American criticisms of Russian aggression were hypocritical, interpreted here by Radio Europe 1.
There are basically no Russian troops abroad, while U.S. troops are everywhere. There are U.S. military bases everywhere around the world, and they are always involved in the fates of other countries, even though they are thousands of kilometers away from U.S. borders. So it's ironic that our U.S. partners accuse us of breaching some of these rules.
Molly Ball, I want to get you on the politics back home here, but Margaret, if I may first, I was in Halifax, Nova Scotia, back in 1995, when Boris Yeltsin was the first Russian to attend what was still then the G7. Russia has been in the heart of this, in the middle of this, ever since, as it became the G8, not there this time. But Vladimir Putin is hardly a shrinking violet on the stage in Europe this week, Margaret.
That's right. And it's interesting in that translation, you heard this definition between no Russian troops. That's not the same thing as saying no Russian influenced forces, no Russian sort of sphere of influence.
Or and weapons, or even, exactly. Ununiformed fighters coming out of Chechnya, you name it, in the Ukraine.
Exactly. And you have seen, as the U.S. government, both the diplomats and top defense officials say here, if Russia wanted to keep forces, paramilitaries or otherwise, they could, out of Ukraine, they could actually maintain their border. But what you're seeing right now is Chechen fighters just flood into the eastern part of that country. You're seeing violence really spike, and the Ukrainian forces now trying to instill some order forcefully.
Do you see a united European front against this Russian aggression at this point, or is that just rhetoric now?
United in rhetoric, united perhaps in what they say they want to achieve, but as you rightly point out, there are different economic perspectives here and priorities among the 28 different countries within the EU and certainly with the United States. There's right now, you're seeing President Obama and some European leaders say, hey, well, we haven't seen troops cross a border and any further land grabs beyond Crimea. Maybe that says that our sanctions so far are successful. But you could also look at the same situation and say, Russia took Crimea. It's not leaving. They may not end up, you know, benefiting from the weight of an economically depressed region being added into their country. But they certainly achieved what they wanted there. And right now you've got Europe disagreeing about what to do next and what type of sanctions they could punish Russia with if it took further steps.
Molly Ball, we're going to bring it back home to a look at a lot of American politics with you, but plenty of turmoil, Molly, at the president's back as he was in Russia for in Europe for all the meetings this week, of course, with the Bo Bergdahl story and much more. Molly Ball with The Atlantic. Please stand by in Washington. Margaret Brennan with CBS News. Music here from the 70th anniversary memorials in Normandy today. So looking back on D-Day, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Bo Bergdahl, D-Day at 70, Obama and Putin squared off in Europe, a big climate push and shootings all over Canada, Seattle. Molly Ball is with us from The Atlantic, joins us from Washington, as does Margaret Brennan, foreign policy reporter for CBS News. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. The week began sort of calmly around the news of Bo Bergdahl's release at a press conference on Sunday. One day after the release, his father, Bob Bergdahl, directly addressed his son.
I hope that when you hear this, and when you're ready to hear this, and when you see this, I hope your English is coming back, and I want you to know that I love you. I'm proud of you.
And in the days that followed, it all blew up politically. Molly Ball, can you describe what happened this week with the Bo Bergdahl story when it hit Washington in full?
Sure. Well, you know, there was originally this Rose Garden ceremony where the president, surrounded by the Bergdahls, the parents, presented this, I think, as sort of an unambiguous feel-good story of having brought home an American who was overseas for was in captivity for such a long time. And that quickly began to fall apart under scrutiny as a lot of these questions were raised. And these are not new questions. This is all stuff that's been reported on at length before. Mm-hmm. The questions about the circumstances of Bo Bergdahl. Bergdahl's disappearance? Did he wander off post? Was he even a deserter? The circumstances of the prisoner exchange, the negotiations with the Taliban, that obviously is also a very tricky arrangement that was arrived at. And so what I think happened was it became very difficult to separate the sort of partisan firestorm over this. People who seemed as if they would just take any opportunity to attack the president and to attack his foreign policy and who see really anything that he could do as of a piece with this preconception that he's weak on foreign policy versus, you know, how much of this was sort of a partisan fight and how much of this was an actual debate that we need to have about what happened here and whether this was a good decision, whether the administration made the right call. I think those things have become very difficult to separate, but it is an ongoing debate. It has become extremely heated. And, you know, with Bo Bergdahl still undergoing what his father calls a decompression, still not speaking speaking, it'll be a while before we have an idea of what really went down.
Lots of layers to this. What was going on there with the Taliban through the Qataris and more? Bo Bergdahl's own behavior, lots of inflammatory talk about that, but some difficult things to understand and describe as well this week. We'll see how that ultimately sorts out. And then the issue of the swap itself for the five Taliban commanders, some senior ones among them, out of Guantanamo. The fact that Congress was not notified, 30-day notice on those releases, as the law requires. On Thursday, speaking from Romania, this was an interview with BBC's Catty Kay, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said that the timing had to be fast. Well, he explained it right here. He said it was about Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's health.
It was our judgment, based on the information that we had, that his life, his health, were in peril. And
imminently?
Well, when you say imminently, it's easy for us to sit here and look behind and say, well, 24 hours, 48 hours. It was our judgment, and it was unanimous, by the way, I might add. It was the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Director of National Intelligence, Attorney General. We all came to the same conclusion that we didn't want to take any chances here.
No chances here, no time to notify Congress. We'll bring that back to Congress. But Margaret Brennan, what about the timing of this, the speed with which it went ahead? Do you see something credibly based on Bo Bergdahl's health? He doesn't look unhealthy at the moment. Or paint the bigger picture for us here of what's going on with the urgency to get him out, how it fits into the whole exit schedule for U.S. troops.
Right. Well, it does fit into that bigger picture because, of course, there have been talks and offers on the table since 2010, 2011 to swap Bergdahl for Taliban detainees. But it picked up fairly quickly here, in part because all of a sudden the Taliban was willing to accept some of these travel bans that they had previously not been willing to consider.
That is, these five have to stay in Qatar for a year is the deal before
exactly.
They can be fully free.
They cannot leave Qatar for a year. They're not under house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
They can walk down the street in Doha, but they're being monitored. Doha's a very small place, and they're being monitored very carefully through security installations, according to U.S. sources and according to the Qataris themselves. But as you also say, that video, that proof of life video that has not been made public, but was shown on Capitol Hill after some of these questions arose about why the administration acted without congressional consent, wasn't convincing to some. What we do know is from various sources that there was no imminent threat. There was no direct threat to Bo Bergdahl in the sense that he was about to be killed. But he was certainly in Taliban captivity for 5 years. That's not good for anyone's health. And that's certainly a dangerous prospect. So he was always sort of at risk of further deterioration. The question here is really what happened on the diplomatic front and what's next there? Because this really could provide an opening, the U.S. hopes, for Afghan-Afghan talks to get the new Afghan government in there talking to the Taliban to try to create a government where the Taliban's not out there fighting to bring down an elected Afghan president.
Is this part of the re-legitimization of the Taliban? There was a lot of celebration. Of course, they put out the video that everyone's looking at now, very dramatic video of that handoff at the side of the Black Hawk helicopter there in the mountains of Afghanistan. But they're now back on the map as a party dealing with the United States. They have their kind of official diplomatic, their one outpost there in Qatar. Does this make them a legitimate player more formally, fully, publicly, Margaret?
Well, in some ways, but that political office has been in existence for over a year now.
Mm-hmm.
That's not new. But what is interesting here that you hear from U.S. defense and diplomatic officials is that they're seeing a split in the Taliban. You don't hear a lot about this, but it's something they're very focused on, where you have a political council, and that's who negotiators were dealing with, who are not necessarily the same thing as the militants in the field, the Taliban fighters that U.S. troops are engaging with in the fight in Afghanistan. And so this bet is that you can empower this political council so that perhaps they can establish command and control, because look, they were able to tell the militants to hand over Bergdahl. And that is seen as really a win from this perspective of, hey, maybe now we can get a Taliban political leadership to become a partner here to negotiate with and that they can get the militants to lay down arms. That's a huge, huge goal here. But it's certainly for U.S. diplomats a sign of hope. And they are trying to empower those politicians more so than the militants who haven't been able to necessarily defeat U.S. forces, but who are waiting for U.S. forces to leave as part of the scheduled drawdown.
Of course, many potential scenarios there, including a straight-out Taliban takeover, many see as entirely possible. Lots of complications here. And then the Bo Bergdahl case, unresolved behind all this. Jane in Louisville, Kentucky. Jane, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. How are you today?
Well, thanks, Jane.
My concern is not his innocence or his guilt. He's a U.S. citizen, should have been brought home sooner than this. There's no question about that. He belongs here in the United States. Whether the military serves to prosecute him later, that's, you know, another issue. I think a bigger issue when you're looking at what possible information could he have relayed to the Taliban about the U.S. military and their operations there, whether voluntary or involuntarily. That, I think, is a bigger concern.
Jane, I appreciate your call. Of course, at the time that he apparently walked off, he was a private first class, promoted to sergeant later. I mean, he was not exactly a top intelligence officer who went off into the hands of the Taliban. But I assume that, and lots of other questions will be asked again here. One more, Brenda in Waterbury, Connecticut. Brenda, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that Bo Bergdahl is everybody's son. If his last name was Hearst or Kennedy or Rockefeller, he would have never been sent over there to begin with. Most of those boys sent over to fight an endless war that we're never going to win were from the middle class. And his life is just as important as the son of a wealthy person.
If there's some appearance of desertion, should he be put on trial once he's home to determine that calmly and coolly, Brenda? Or is 5 years enough, as somebody in the Pentagon said along the way already?
I think seeing combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think those boys have already paid the price. And I think putting their life on the line for an endless war that's basically, I feel, over oil is just wrong. We were wrong to go into that war to begin with, and we were wrong to sacrifice thousands of young men's lives in a war that we're never going to win.
Well,
and I feel that he's already paid the price. Why vilify the young man now when he's coming home?
You know, we have heard from his military colleagues some serious unhappiness about his behavior then and what it may have cost others. We heard it on this show this week. But, Brenda, we take your point. Molly, Jack, I want to come back to the firestorm at home. There was a lot of criticism here of the swap itself, saying, first of all, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Others said, well, these aren't terrorists. These are the Taliban. They were, and maybe again, the government of Afghanistan. But then also the price, the deal. Here was Senator John McCain. This was on Tuesday. This kept rolling. But here was McCain criticizing the prisoner swap for Bo Bergdahl.
These are wanted war criminals. One of them is supposedly guilty of murdering thousands of Shiite Muslims while he was in charge outside of, I believe, Kandahar. So this decision to bring Sergeant Bergdahl home, and we applaud that he is home, is ill-founded, it is a mistake, and it is putting the lives of American servicemen and women at risk, and that, to me, is unacceptable.
John McCain there. Molly Ball in Washington. Have we moved the goalposts on what the U.S. does with opponents, let's say, abroad in this negotiation and swap? And what about the deal itself? The White House, Pentagon, has said Monday morning quarterbacking. How are people looking at it, Molly?
Well, there has been a lot of heat from Congress. And as you mentioned, there's the notification issue. Even some Democrats in Congress, Senator Dianne Feinstein, has criticized the fact that Congress wasn't notified as the law requires. On the other hand, there does seem to be a bit of partisan opportunism, especially on the part of Senator McCain, who previously said that he would have agreed to this deal. And now he says, well, it's the specifics of the deal that I have a problem with, not the idea of the deal. But basically, this exact exact deal with these exact same prisoners from Guantanamo has been on the table for years now. And McCain was aware of who it was we were proposing to exchange with the Taliban and previously said he thought that would probably be okay. So he does seem to have flip-flopped a little there. And I think that's part of what obscures this issue. And then, you know, you have some of the sort of fringe of the Republican Party, the extreme right, saying, oh, look, you know, his dad has a beard. He spoke in Arabic at the Rose Garden. He's some kind of secret Muslim. And this plays into all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories about Obama wanting to convert the United States to Islam. And I think when Republicans start getting into that area, they really lose people. They really start to sound just conspiratorial and crazy.
Of course, his father got into languages in the hope of helping release his son and the beard. I guess that could just as easily be a Duck Dynasty beard. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
You know, Tom, it's not very often that I disagree with you, but I have to disagree with the statement you made about 5 minutes ago. You said, and it's something that's been going around, well, he looked healthy, and, you know, the last time I saw Magic Johnson, he looked very healthy, but we know that he has HIV.
But he's not. His life is not in imminent danger.
Right. Well, he's in imminent danger because he's with the Taliban, and at any moment they could shoot him. You know, you can get a suicide bomber could just say, you know what, I don't like holding this guy. I want to take him out. I'm going to blow him up.
So right to bring him back? And what about the reception that he's had here, Carl?
Well, to me, the Republican Party has stooped to another level of sickness that even I didn't think they could get. The resentment and hatement towards President Obama by the Republican Party, it even overshadows bringing home an American POW. And if you don't believe me, just believe your eyes. Look at all the tweets that was tweeted out immediately after he was had been released and been sent to Germany. They were all saying, welcome home, and then immediately after that, they were erased. Their tweets. John McCain just 2 years ago said that he would take this same deal. And in fact, several news outlets have reported that these five guys had already been talked about in 2011 to be released. So there was, I don't understand why they were all surprised that these guys were scheduled to be released.
Yeah, already in the air. Carl, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much right there. Jack Beatty, I have to say, it was sad to see the people of Bo Bergdahl's hometown, yes, who were prepared to welcome him home and had rallied around his parents, have to kind of shut that down, in part under a torrent of online abuse from all kinds of critics here. There is a kind of common decency, even if there somewhere ends up here being a trial, but a kind of common decency in bringing an American soldier home and out of POW status. What do you make of what we've seen unfold around this story this week, Jack?
Yes, a common decency and an indecency, really, in demonizing this young man without knowing more of the facts.
Well, but there are facts. I mean, there. I guess I'd say there are even facts out there that are troubling at this point. But you're right. We've got a system here. We don't demonize. We get it all out. In this case, perhaps in a military court.
Perhaps. But, you know, I do think the New York Times in their editorial today, the rush to demonize Sergeant Bergdahl, really makes a good point. They end by saying, but the critics seeking political advantage don't care about the life or mental state of a particular soldier or of a principle of loyalty that should provide comfort to any soldier in danger of capture. They live only for the attack. I mean, there is an element here of simply, there is nothing this president could do in foreign relations especially that would win him other than the censure of a whole, you know, an industry practically. I mean, it's been hate week on Fox News. I mean, they just have been going, you know, the beard, every single soldier who's, and the soldiers are warranted in their dismay about his conduct, sure, but it's all been brought out and it's all been ganging up on this guy, and the main thing has been lost sight of, you know, an American who was in desperate situation is now going to come home to his parents. Any parent must think, my God, that's wonderful.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a big vigil in Hong Kong marked the 25th anniversary of China's 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. One woman there explained why she joined the big Hong Kong crowd.
As much as the government would like us to forget about it, I don't think we should. And for the future generations, I really hope that they will continue doing so as well.
A 12-year-old Wisconsin girl stabbed nearly to death by two middle school classmates who apparently attacked her to please a fictional online horror character, Slender Man, a passing cyclist called 911.
Came upon a 12-year-old female. She appears to be stabbed.
She appears to be what?
Stabbed.
Stabbed?
And the last living Navajo code talker from World War II, Chester Nez, died this week at 93. He spoke with NPR in 2011 about hard times and places in World War II's Pacific Theater fighting through the islands.
It's one of the most terrible places that I have been, hitting the beach to see some of your friends lying around the coast dying out, and I think that's one thing that I'll never forget. But I was very lucky and very, very, very proud to be one of the Navajo code talkers.
Chester Nez, gone this week at 93. We're looking at a week in the news with Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Margaret Brennan of CBS News. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. Molly Ball, I want to go right to Mississippi and the Republican primary for U.S. Senate there this week. You have written, I must say, just marvelously out of there, Molly. Thank you so much for reporting. Just terrific stories. Set it up for us. Yeah, it was just great reporting. Head-to-head, who has been, who is it, and what was the outcome, and what does it mean, Molly?
Yeah, well, you know, I think pundits sometimes shoehorn these Republican primaries into this narrative of Tea Party versus Republican establishment when it doesn't exactly fit. But in this case, you could hardly get a more pure distillation of both narratives. On the one hand, you have Senator Thad Cochran. He's been serving in Washington for 41 years. He's been he's seeking a seventh term in the Senate. And you know, he's 76 years old. He's known for his ability to bring earmarks back to his state. This is very much a sort of old school style of Republican and indeed Washington Senate service. And it's something that the Tea Party has explicitly set itself against. It said that the kind of Republican we want is the sort of pure ideological, fiscally conservative Republican, not the one who makes deals and sits on the Appropriations Committee handing out pork and bringing back pork to his state. It's not clear whether Senator Cochran has a lot of fire in the belly these days. He said relatively recently that he would have preferred to retire, but people told him that they just couldn't live without him. And he's facing this primary challenge from a state senator, Chris McDaniel, who, again, is a very pure sort of avatar of what the Tea Party stands for. He has attacked Senator Cochran as this sort of go along to get along Washington insider. He speaks of wanting to of this sort of nostalgia for an America that is against the present culture that is frightening and confusing to a lot of people and bringing it back. And so he's been supported by the Club for Growth and the Senate Conservatives Fund and the Tea Party Patriots and Sarah Palin has come out and campaigned for him all the sort of national right-wing forces have backed him. Meanwhile, Senator Cochran is supported by a lot of the Mississippi establishment. When I was with him this week in Meridian and Jackson, Mississippi, the governor of Mississippi was there and the lieutenant governor and all kinds of Mississippi politicos trying to sort of prop him up. Mississippi is a very conservative state. The Republicans there are very conservative. There has been this bizarre scandal involving Senator Cochran's wife, who's in a nursing home, and some supporters of Chris McDaniel apparently broke in and took her picture. That sort of clouded the picture in the last couple weeks. So the result of this was an almost exact tie, really an unbelievable result. There's a third-party candidate who didn't campaign at all, who's a nobody, but he must have been sort of a protest vote for only about less than 2% of the voters. And because of that, the two candidates deadlocked right around 49%. Mm-hmm. Chris McDaniel getting a couple thousand votes more. And now they are headed to what was seen as a very improbable circumstance, a runoff in 3 weeks.
And of course, this being Mississippi, the winner of the Republican primary, essentially the winner of the Senate seat, Republicans going hell for leather for a U.S. Senate majority. A lot of firepower being brought in here. I want to examine this a little more closely here. Let's just get the sound of these two men. This was Monday, the day before the primary that Molly covered in Mississippi. Republican Senator Thad Cochran talked at the Mississippi Agriculture and Forestry Museum in Jackson.
We've come a long way in Mississippi, and with a Republican majority, together we can make this Mississippi's moment. President Obama has taken us down some wrong paths, but starting tomorrow, we can get America back on the right path.
Thad Cochran, his Tea Party-backed opponent, Chris McDaniel, spoke at a rally in Ellisville, Mississippi last Friday. Molly Ball reports him routinely casting his mission, not as a break with the past, but as a bulwark against a frightening future. He said at the rally, millions in this country feel like strangers in this land. Then went on to say this.
An older America is passing away and a new America is rising to take its place. There are many of us that recoil from that culture. It's foreign to us. It's offensive to us.
A new America is rising to take the place of the old. And there you have Chris McDaniel, Jack Beatty, saying, you know, there are a lot of us that recoil from that. It's foreign to us. It's offensive to us. There's the bulwark message that Molly's writing about.
Yes, a great piece of reporting to have captured that. And, you know, it's almost as if the political unconscious was speaking there, because he was laying bare what, as Molly rightly says, social scientists have been saying about the strain of the Tea Party, that it's informed by status anxiety, the feeling that a group is losing its position relative to other groups, a kind of protest movement of the haves to hold on to what they have because they're threatened by the seeming have-nots. And, you know, this comes just as a paper has recently been published by two professors called More Diverse Yet Less Tolerant. And it explores what happens to racial and ethnic attitudes when you present white voters with findings of the census that show that whites are going to be a minority here after 2042. And what it finds is that the percentage of whites who are bothered by that, quote, by that idea of an America where most people are not white, that percentage actually increases when they're told about the demographic facts. In other words, the country is going to become more diverse, and at the same time, white voters citizens in this survey are saying, we don't like that, and we don't even want to hear that. And there's just no doubt that feeling of we want to hold on to our to who we are, and this new America, as Chris McDaniel says, we recoil from it. It's foreign to us. That element is very strong in the Tea Party.
Molly, let me ask you about that. Jack has portrayed it there as status anxiety of a group. We've had conservative thinkers on even just this week saying, no, what this is about is a change. As to be fair, Chris McDaniel explicitly said there of a culture. Conservative thinkers saying there's a new culture which doesn't adhere to values and an outlook on life that has made the country successful, not putting it in terms of racial terms or demographic terms, but in terms of outlook, attitude, an attitude that, you know, they would say has made America a winner.
Well, I think regardless of what's behind it, it is clear that there are people in this country who are uncomfortable with its direction. And sometimes this is expressed as, you know, antagonism toward the president, antagonism toward Democrats. The parties are increasingly sorted into ideological camps and to demographic camps, not only in terms of race, but you have the Democrats increasingly becoming an urban liberal party and Republicans increasingly representing rural people and older people and people who feel that the country that they once knew is slipping away. So it is this clash of cultures, really, of mindsets that is underlaid by a lot of those demographics that you talk about, but I think has to do with just people's discomfort with the pace of change.
Diane in Long Beach, Mississippi. Diane, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I always enjoy your show. I love it today, too.
Thank you.
I just wanted to give you a little on-the-ground comment. So I voted in the primary Tuesday. I vote Democrat. We don't register by party here, so you can go on a given primary and vote either way. And I was quite surprised by the results because I thought that Cochran would take it very easily just because of I thought there would be an alliance of old, you know, people who, the Republicans who support Cochran along with Democrats who crossed, because I will tell you that my husband is the only liberal and Democrat that I know besides myself who actually voted in the Democratic primary. Not to say some didn't, but everyone I know just about who has never voted Republican in their lives crossed and voted in the Republican primary to support Cochran because they're terrified of McDaniel. So when I voted that morning at 9 o'clock, I was the third Democrat to vote in the 100th voter, which it's never been that lopsided. So I just was surprised at the results, frankly.
Diane, as we heard on NPR just this morning, the reporting saying that the Republicans are actively courting Democratic votes. Cochran is actively looking to bring them out. There's no secret about it, Diane.
Right. And of course, you know, the Democratic Party chair was calling everyone this week because he was so concerned to, you know, Democrats, get out, vote in your primary, but people didn't. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't know. I think, but on the other hand, a lot of Democrats that I know, we were all pretty much supporting McDaniel winning because we thought we have a much better chance for Childers to take. I told somebody yesterday who knows Cochran, I said, you know, I think if he loses, he needs to endorse Childers. And they said, no way, that won't happen.
The Democrat, not going to happen. Diane, I appreciate your call from Mississippi very much. Well, this is really interesting. Molly Ball, how are people reading this? We've heard people saying they're doubling down. Matt Kibbe has been on with us from FreedomWorks, big Tea Party guy, saying they're going to pull out all the money stops now to try and get this in the Tea Party quarter. On the other hand, Cochran folks reaching out all over, including to independents and Democrats. What do people see coming, Molly?
Well, that is very interesting what the caller was talking about, the sort of dilemma Democrats find themselves in, because even though you sort of dismissed the possibility earlier, there is a Democratic candidate who's viewed as relatively strong.
Okay.
And there are Travis Childers, a former member of Congress. Now, a Democrat hasn't gone to the Senate from Mississippi since 1982, and it's a very red state, but it is seen as a possibility.
Okay. Respect to Travis Childers. I stand corrected.
Only if McDaniel wins that Republican primary. Mm-hmm. So you do have Democrats saying, on the one hand, they're scared to death of having Chris McDaniel be their senator, and they're inclined to support Thad Cochran. As a result, Thad Cochran is someone who has reached across the aisle in his career and who has benefited a lot of the lower income people in his state by the federal money that he's helped bring home. On the other hand, a lot of Democrats feel like on a strategic level, if McDaniel wins this primary, it's better for them because that's the only thing that would give their candidate a fighting chance in the general election. So you do have the Cochran campaign saying this is their strategy in the runoff. Their strategy is to assert Cochran as the candidate for all Mississippians and try to get Democrats and independents to come out and support him by raising the specter of a Senator McDaniel and making them afraid of that. The McDaniel campaign is using this against Cochran, saying, see, we told you he was a Republican in name only. There he goes talking about how Democrats should vote for him. So we'll see which argument is more persuasive to those voters in the runoff. It's likely to be a very low turnout affair.
A time coming up. What, June 23rd, I think, is that runoff?
I believe that's right, or the 24th, perhaps.
Our time is short here. I want to touch on, and Margaret, get your sense of the international reaction to Monday's EPA announcement that they're pushing a new regulation for power plants in the United States that would cut emissions from 05 levels by 30% by 2030, part of a push on the climate change front. Here's EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy.
We may not agree on the details of how we do it, but I sure do hope we can all agree on why we do it. When our kids ask us if we did everything we could to leave them a safer, cleaner world, we all want to say, yes, we did.
Margaret Brennan, there will be years domestically of wrangling over how this will be done. A lot of room left for states to decide how they go at it. But everyone says in the end, this will have to be just the U.S. part of a global effort to address climate change. I read somebody tweeting this week saying we're all Chinese now, in the sense that it may be their policy that ultimately decides, you know, if we tip into some fiery hell or not. What about global response to the U.S. push here, Margaret?
Well, broadly speaking, one of the things that makes it quite difficult for Secretary Kerry or any other diplomat to go abroad and pressure the Chinese or others is when they can point back to what's not happening in the United States to start to mitigate some of the pollution and some of the long-term damage here. And actually, just next week, there's going to be a big conference in Washington. Secretary Kerry is pushing on oceans to try to get some unanimity here and really try to make it clear that this could be a national security concern because of in potential refugee flows, because of potential damage to landmass, et cetera. When you draw out some of the worst case scenarios, it makes it look like there should be immediate action. So it is something on the foreign policy front that this administration is pushing, but it's honestly really hard to get on people's radars when there's not an immediate emergency situation at hand.
Well, they come and come and come again, perhaps, and we'll watch those ocean waters. Jack Beatty, we've just got a couple of seconds here, but GM, has Mary Barra, the CEO there, dodged the bullet with her big press conference? They bring out their own internal report done by the former federal attorney saying, incompetence, not cover-up.
And the incompetence is shocking, and it's so chronic over such a long period, really since 2002, 2001, that if it's not a cover-up, then then a new word needs to be developed. And also this, a former U.S. attorney, but also a person whose law firm has done a lot of business with GM. I don't know how much credibility this report will have. The Congress is still going to want to know more.
One more anniversary this week. Bruce Springsteen's classic album Born in the USA turns 30 this week. It's right behind us here. Molly Ball with The Atlantic, thanks for joining us. Great to have you today, Molly.
Thank you, Tom.
Margaret Brennan with CBS News. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Follow me at Tom Ashbrook, NPR on Twitter. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.